Bellefonte to Wellsboro, Reading to Uniontown, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, a new study by the Commonwealth Foundation details the devastating financial cost of Pennsylvania's dalliance with the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGI. Stephen Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation and Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association are here for a Capital Watch discussion. And independent voters are just that, independent. They are not members of a political party and should not participate in party primaries. I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Odd things tend to happen in Pennsylvania politics, and this week proved to be no exception. First, Axios reported that Rob Brooks, the Democrat congressional candidate endorsed by Governor Josh Shapiro in a hotly contested Lehigh Valley primary race, said that Shapiro, quote, secretly helped Republican State Treasurer Stacey Garrity's 2024 reelection bid. The famously thin-skinned Shapiro was apparently miffed that Erin McClellan, the Democrat nominee for treasurer, had dissed his bid to become Kamala Harris's vice presidential running mate. Garrity won that election with the largest vote ever for a statewide candidate in Pennsylvania, and the upcoming primary, she will become the Republican nominee for governor to take on Shapiro in the general election. The revelation is proving embarrassing to Shapiro, and Brooks, of course, is now claiming that he misspoke. Meanwhile, rumors continue to swirl around Pennsylvania U.S. Senator John Fetterman. Fetterman has angered the dominant left wing of his party by occasionally thinking for himself. Politico reports that Senate Republicans and President Donald Trump are working hard to persuade Fetterman to switch parties or at least become an independent. This, as the GOP is fighting a tough battle to retain control of the upper chamber. For his part, Fetterman has consistently said he will not be switching parties. One of the most hotly contested congressional races in Pennsylvania this year is for the seat of U.S. Representative Scott Perry, whose district includes Harrisburg and York. Democrats are engaged in a divisive primary between former television anchor Janelle Stelson, who lost to Perry 2 years ago, and Dauphin County Commissioner Justin Douglas. Stelson is viewed as the front runner for the nomination. She is refusing to debate Douglas, who hails from the far left wing of the party. Stelson's debate with Perry 2 years ago was a train wreck, with the former anchor at times appearing confused and uttering incoherent answers. The experience likely contributed to her refusal to share a stage with the more articulate Douglas. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Our Capital Watch crew has a number of topics to discuss this week, ranging from the financial impact of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative to school choice to the impact of high gas prices on the supply chain. Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation is sitting in today as host for David Taylor. He is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Stephen?
Welcome to Capital Watch, where we keep our eyes on what's happening under the Capitol Dome for you. I'm Steve Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation, and I'm joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Welcome, Rebecca.
Great to be here with you, Steve.
We're going to delve into some issues surrounding, it's going to be a mixed bag. I want to start off with a question, and Rebecca, I'll ask you this, but it's more of a just an experiment.
Uh-oh.
We knew it was bad, now we know how bad it was.
Yes. So,
What do you think we might be talking about?
My guess would be the governor's REGI policy, Steve. Would I be right about that?
You are on point.
Awesome.
It's gone now. It was ended both by the courts and the legislature at the end of last year. So it's gone, but we have to make sure it doesn't come back. And unfortunately, Governor Shapiro has made a number of attempts at this point to recreate some of the big elements of REGI and use them again in his plans, PACER and PRESS, and his other greenhouse gas proposals he's been talking about. So what we know now is how much damage REGI actually did to Pennsylvania's economy over the 6 years that it was being kicked around and the things that happened. And it turns out in Commonwealth Foundation, one of our main emphases is on making sure we have clear policies that actually enhance free market activities and make Pennsylvania citizens more prosperous and thrive. But we found out that this regional greenhouse gas initiative had such a severe negative impact through a large research project that Commonwealth Foundation did. And I just want to hit a few of the highlights from the research on the impact of REGI on our economy here in Pennsylvania. And I'm going to quote my colleague Elizabeth Stell, who's Vice President of Policy for Commonwealth Foundation. She has some information out just released yesterday. And I want to just quote some of the things she said about the situation with REGI and the prospect that the governor Shapiro will end up pushing forward something like the reincarnation of REGI. So again, quoting Elizabeth Stell, the Keystone State's six-year on-again, off-again relationship with REGI is a cautionary tale for other states, such as Virginia. REGI is a tax on every user of electricity, toppling the energy future of every state it touches. In the 6 years under REGI, Pennsylvania lost between $5 billion and $8 billion in investment in our energy structure.
Wow.
The Commonwealth lost enough electricity to power the entire Pittsburgh metro area. While Pennsylvania debated and litigated and delayed over carbon tax policy, Ohio, which we know the Governor Shapiro likes to talk about how he wants to compete with Ohio, delayed over carbon tax policy. Ohio provided developers with a predictable regulatory environment to commit billions in capital. Projects in Pennsylvania were canceled as the project pipeline in Ohio boomed.
Wow. And this is really striking because, I mean, we all know that energy prices are one of the biggest concerns right now in the economy, and consumers are dealing with higher energy costs. And as we talk about the impact of data centers on the energy environment here in the Commonwealth and throughout the country, too, energy costs are a major concern for consumers and for businesses as well. So when we look at the lost production value of all that energy that could have been here in Pennsylvania, it's really tragic to think what we lost. And it's like you said, businesses, they really depend on certainty to make decisions about where to locate major investments. And when we had this sort of on and off again sort of policy, REGI was on and then it was potentially off and then it was back on again. It was as it was working its way through the courts and the legislature over the course of those 6 years, businesses and energy and investors were trying to determine whether or not to put money in Pennsylvania. And when you have that uncertainty, they decided not to, apparently, and they went elsewhere, right?
Great, exactly. And we have the documentation. So despite Pennsylvania's REGI exit, Governor Josh Shapiro continues to champion an even more extreme taxing scheme through the Lightning Plan. Again, quoting my colleague Elizabeth Stelf, based on the research she just completed on REGI and the impact of REGI on the economy here for the last 6 years. Elements of this plan include the Pennsylvania Climate Emissions Reduction Act, PACER, and Pennsylvania Reliable Energy Sustainability Standard, PRESS, programs, would cost Pennsylvania $157.2 billion and more than double residential electricity bills. Affordable, reliable energy is not achieved through the Green New Deal-style mandates and burdensome regulation. The pre-REGI years show a stable regulatory environment can attract investment in Pennsylvania needs and bring down electricity costs and unleash our energy assets. Pennsylvania is uniquely positioned to dominate American energy independence, but only if lawmakers focus on bolstering, not undermining, our energy sector.
I mean, that says it all right there. I mean, we really do need to do everything we can to support Pennsylvania's energy development. And correct me if I'm wrong, but before this even started, Pennsylvania's emissions, I mean, if really the focus is emissions, as the governor's trying to push his agenda here, emissions were substantially down in the energy sector over the course of the past couple of decades because of our move to Pennsylvania's clean natural gas in the energy sector. So Pennsylvania has a real advantage there in that we have the second largest natural gas reserve here in the country, and we really could focus on using that to our advantage and the advantage of our economy and bringing costs down for consumers.
So we knew it was bad. Now we know how bad it was. Now it's gone, but we have to make sure that it doesn't come back. Let's switch gears a little bit, and I want to talk about some of the things and activities focused on educational choice in Pennsylvania. And just in this last legislative week, Representative Martina White introduced a resolution designating May 17th, 2026 as the 25th anniversary of the Educational Improvement Tax Credit Program in Pennsylvania. And so this is just a legislative recognition, but it brings up an important point that the EITC program in Pennsylvania, the Educational Improvement Tax Credit Program, which is our flagship school choice program in Pennsylvania and was started back around 2001 in our legislature and enacted and expanded. And over the years, it continues to grow and become more and more important. And it's really become a model for Pennsylvania and for the nation. When you look at the recent federal legislation that creates the federal scholarship tax credit nationwide, it actually is based on the model of EITC. So we've impacted in Pennsylvania, we've impacted national policy by our successful deployment of the EITC program in Pennsylvania. And now that's sort of spawned or encouraged the growth of the federal scholarship tax credit program. And that's a new credit that will allow $1,700 credits to donors. And it ultimately will go to scholarships for children that will open up all sorts of opportunities. But the catch is, each state has to opt in before they can utilize the program for the actual distribution of benefits in their state. About 30 or so states have so far opted in, but some haven't. And among those who haven't is Pennsylvania. And so the governor is kind of standing by and I guess watching to see how it goes. He's saying he wants to make sure that any additional guidance that the legislature is or that the government provides Pennsylvania to understand what rules and regulation will apply. That has delayed his decision. I'm not sure if that's the case or what it is that's driving his. So far, he hasn't been willing to opt into the program, but we're hoping that that does happen because if not, we would literally have taxpayers in Pennsylvania donating dollars that they would get a credit for, but instead of helping kids in Pennsylvania, the program would help kids in other states. And it would be depriving Pennsylvania of that potential additional revenue, which could be extremely significant. So the celebration of the EITC is really part of enhancing people's understanding of all the tax credit programs and other school choice programs in Pennsylvania that have been increasingly successful, but really all started with the EITC back in 2001.
Wow, that's a great success story, and the fact that the federal government is sort of emulating what Pennsylvania started so long ago. But I just want to make sure I understand. So you're saying that in this federal program, Pennsylvania businesses can take part in this federal tax credit, but until we opt into it, our students here won't be able to take advantage of it?
Correct.
Wow. Gosh, that's amazing. So I hope cooler heads prevail and we'll be able to take advantage of that.
Indeed. And you're listening to Capital Watch. Rebecca, I know you brought along some notes and some thoughts on some different subjects. And I want to jump in by inviting you to start out with your discussion about the supply chain and what's happening in terms of everything from the war in Iran to other activities right here in the United States and even more locally to Pennsylvania.
Sure. I've been getting a lot of questions lately about the cost of diesel. As you can imagine, it's really extremely high right now. And in Pennsylvania, especially since we have about the second highest diesel and gas tax in the country here. So folks are seeing the fuel costs exceedingly high in Pennsylvania, and it's a little bit of sticker shock. So we've been getting a lot of questions about it. So I thought it might be a good idea to talk through some of what we're seeing here. And I did want to take a step back and talk a little bit about the supply chain, because I think what I would say is the defining theme right now is uncertainty. So sort of coming back to what we talked about Reggie, businesses do not like uncertainty. So in the supply chain and in the trucking sector, last year it was tariffs. So tariffs were causing a lot of bit of uncertainty in our industry and throughout the economy. This year, it's the cost of diesel, because it really is a huge cost for trucking companies. It's their first or second operating cost, right next to their HR costs usually. So it is a huge operating cost. It's often about 25 to 30% of a trucking company's total expenses. So when diesel is high, it affects everything from pricing to planning to basic day-to-day operations in a trucking company. So when the fuel is high, it's not just the cost of the fuel, it's also the uncertainty, because you know, it may be high today. Is it going to be higher tomorrow? What's it going to be like next week as you're writing contracts for hauling freight in a week or in a month? So it's that uncertainty which really, of course, causes a lot of problems.
Just like we were talking about in the energy markets, it's very similar in this situation as well.
Exactly. Yep. And it's particularly hard on small companies and owner-operators because they don't buy fuel in bulk necessarily, and they have to front the cost to fill up their tanks, which right now is $1,700 to $2,000 in some cases to fill up one 18-wheeler. So it's an enormous cost. So they have to fill up their tank before they can collect any fuel surcharges from their customers a month or so down the road. So it's really difficult on small companies. So I don't want to minimize it at all. High fuel costs really do create ripple effects throughout the entire supply chain. So it's not just trucks. It's also trains and tankers on the ocean that also use diesel. So anytime something moves on a ship, a train, or a truck, those higher costs get added at every step through the supply chain. So it really ripples throughout the supply chain, and that's part of the reason we're seeing higher prices on everything we buy. So these high costs are really affecting the entire economy, and that creates real pressure, of course. Operating costs rise immediately, and the other part of that is because prices are higher, people are buying less things, so that reduces demand for things too. So that also impacts the trucking companies out on the road. But one of the things I wanted to talk about, which we don't hear about often, is it's kind of only part of the story, because underlying that volatility, I think over the past year or so, the fundamentals in the freight market and in the supply chain actually have changed a little bit for the better. So I wanted to put a sort of an optimistic spin on things, which you don't hear a lot right now.
We like that. In Pennsylvania, we need that.
Yes, that's right. Well, the first thing I wanted to say is that we're no longer overly reliant on foreign oil for our needs, which is one really positive thing. The U.S. is now the world's largest oil exporter. We still import about 30% of the oil we consume, but most of it's from Canada. We only get about 8% of our oil from the Persian Gulf region now, which is a huge improvement from where we are. 20 years ago, we used to get 60% of our oil from abroad. So that's really good news for us here in the U.S. And second of all, I also wanted to say that we're seeing a lot of stability and some early signs of growth for the trucking industry from elsewhere in the economy, which is a good thing because it's really been in recession for about the last 3 years. And part of that is that the U.S. manufacturing industries are starting to make a comeback. We're starting to see expansion in manufacturing. Housing is starting to come back. Recently, we saw a 13-month high in single-family housing starts and other industrial activity like energy. We talked about energy, infrastructure, and technology investment are starting to come back. And we've seen that with some major investments and projects here in Pennsylvania, which we've talked about on the show. So demand is starting to come back a little bit, and that's helping the supply chain, helping the industry out in trucking. And most importantly, it's getting to be that it's stable enough to support the market. And the other thing is that on the capacity side, there's some good news. So the trucking industry has gone through a correction over the past few years. So even though there's been a lot of rising costs with fuel, insurance, regulatory pressures, we're seeing some positive trends too. Tax stability this year at the national level was a great thing. We've had some repeal of some unnecessary and onerous environmental regulations. We know that regulatory certainty and sort of cutting red tape helps businesses. And the federal government started to crack down on some questionable trucking companies that probably shouldn't really have been operating in the first place, which were undercutting companies that were doing things the right way. So that is starting to reset the industry a little bit, and it's led to more discipline level of capacity. So we're starting to see the results of that. Freight rates are starting to go up, and the forecasts are calling for a double-digit rate growth in trucking over the course of this year. So that's really good to hear. And in Pennsylvania, we're at the center of the Northeast Corridor. Major freight moves through Pennsylvania constantly. So I guess what I want to say is I'm hoping that this diesel issue that we're seeing, this fuel volatility is really just sort of masking what otherwise is a strengthening market. So when we start to see a reset with the fuel costs, I really think we're going to be in a different position moving forward. And we're set to start seeing growth in the industry. The supply chain is going to reset, and we're really going to be off to the races when this issue resolves in the Middle East.
It's good to hear that, and especially because of your perspective with the trucking industry and the distribution industry. It's so indicative of so many other levels of activity in the economy.
You have
a real bird's eye view to determine what's happening and what isn't happening. It sounds like what you're seeing is encouraging news across the board in terms of economic activity here.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think we've seen a lot of things resolve in the economy over the course of the past year or two, and trends in the right direction. So I do think that fuel and in some cases energy costs, as we talked about, need some more stability and need some predictability. But we're headed in the right direction, and we're hoping that this diesel and gas blip that we're seeing, and it is, don't get me wrong, it is problematic and it is affecting prices. We're hoping it's temporary, and we can handle it short term. It's long term stability that we really need, which is going to reset things and hopefully set us on a course to success.
And some of the key to what you described is the lack of oppressive regulations.
Yes.
It's a situation where the model we talk about of a free market economy is working. And so as long as the government doesn't poke its damaging fingers into the cake, we're looking really good economically.
That's exactly
here in the country. That's good to hear. I like to hear that again. And because of your unique perspective, you have that sort of bird's eye view of what's happening economically from all sorts of different sectors that all converge in the distribution and trucking sector. So thanks for you and what your members do. We're getting close here to the Pennsylvania budget season. I'm sure we'll be talking about that over the next several weeks. But as of now, the legislative chambers have both recessed until June, and then all the activity will be accelerating along that. So we'll see some of this play out in terms of how it interacts with the state budget in the coming months, which is also super important. That's all the time we're going to have for today. Rebecca, thank you for being here. And can you talk about where folks can find you and your organization on the web?
Absolutely. They can find information about the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association at pmta.org.
And you can always find information about me at the Commonwealth Foundation, commonwealthfoundation.org. And for Rebecca and myself, we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary by Loman Henry.
In a few days, Pennsylvania voters will go to the polls and vote in the primary election. The Commonwealth is what is known as a closed primary state. Voters must register Republican to vote in the Republican primary and Democrat to vote in the Democrat primary. Those who register as independent, unaffiliated, or in minor parties cannot vote in the primaries of the two major political parties. Every year at this time, a clamor arises for so-called open primaries, essentially to allow registered independents to vote in the primary of whatever party they may choose. It is true that independent is the most rapidly growing category of voters in Penn's Woods, but the argument that independent voters are somehow being discriminated against because they cannot vote in party primaries is specious. By registering independent, a voter is stating they do not wish to belong to one of the two major parties. This is a conscious and valid choice, but it is their choice. A political party primary is just that, the mechanism by which members of that party select their nominees who will compete in the general election. It is not the first round of general election voting. As a registered Republican and one who has been active in the Republican Party my entire adult life, I do not want Democrats or anyone not a member of the Republican Party deciding our standard bearer. Open primaries would in fact deprive us of the ability to select candidates who adhere to the principles and policies. In some jurisdictions, party affiliation is so lopsided that the winner of the primary is essentially elected. This is true mostly in larger cities like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and in other urban areas around the state with heavily Democrat registrations. Open primary advocates say independents thus have little to no voice in the process because the primary is essentially the election. But the same is true for Republicans in those areas who have no say in the Democrat primaries and who face long odds in November. But you don't hear Republicans complaining. Now, it is true that a growing number of state senatorial and legislative districts are uncompetitive. However, the cause of this is not Pennsylvania's closed primary system, but an excessively gerrymandered set of district maps purposefully designed to be non-competitive to give state Democrats an electoral advantage. Open primaries also open the door to electoral chicanery. Such a system would allow members of an opposition party to cross over and vote in large numbers in an opposing party's competitive primary to ensure the nomination of the weakest general election candidate. For example, a competitive Democrat primary is currently underway for a U.S. House seat in the Lehigh Valley. Open primaries would allow Republicans to cross over and vote for the perceived weakest Democrat to face their incumbent in November. Pennsylvania voters got a taste of this in 2022 when then-Attorney General Josh Shapiro was unopposed for the Democrat gubernatorial nomination while Republicans were engaged in a nine-candidate brawl. Supporters of Shapiro believe State Senator Doug Mastriano to be the weakest potential general election candidate and engaged in efforts to push Republican voters his way. Open primaries would make such hijinks easier and more frequent. The current closed primary system, in one way, gives independent voters more political power. In most cases, certainly in statewide elections, neither Republicans nor Democrats can win without appealing to and winning the support of independent voters. Independent voters essentially now hold the balance of power in their hands. Finally, there is the question of election integrity. There remains a significant segment of the electorate that lacks confidence in our electoral system. The existence of no-excuse mail-in voting is viewed as an area of potential fraud. Unsecured ballot drop boxes and other mechanisms employed during the COVID era continue to be a point of concern. Add into the mix the administrative complexity of allowing voters to show up at the polls on Election Day and then declare in what primary they want to vote adds just another security weak point. The bottom line, just as registered Republicans make a choice to be Republican, registered Democrats make a choice to be a Democrat, registered independents make a choice to be independent. That is a choice that must be respected, but it is a choice, not discrimination by the system. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 31 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WRAK-AM in Williamsport, WLCY-AM in Indiana, along with WIOO-FM in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, all of whom have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Thank you. From the Frederick W. Anton III Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.